The song you just heard was Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation, and that's what we need to be doing. I'm Michael Slate, and we're bringing you a special broadcast. It's a two-hour broadcast of the emergency meeting to stop the Trump-Pence regime before it starts. This critical organizing meeting took place on December 19th in New York City's Cooper Union. At least 260 people came out on very short notice, and over 250,000 watched it online. The evening was the launch of an audacious new movement, RefuseFascism.org, which aims to rapidly transform the deep anguish and outrage, the unease, concern, and outright terror that is felt by millions and millions in this country into resistance and defiance and acts of political rebellion and radical art, and no, powerful enough to stop Trump and Pence before they start. You are listening to part one of this special broadcast. In part one, you're going to hear Sansara Taylor, the MC and a writer for Revolution Newspaper, P.Z. Myers, biologist and professor at the University of Minnesota Morris and the author of the Feringula blog, Fran Luck, the executive director of Joy of Resistance Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI in New York, Chase Iron Eyes, part of the fight of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe against the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline, and Jeremy Scahill, founding senior editor of The Intercept, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. So let's begin with Sansara Taylor introducing P.Z. Myers, followed by Fran Luck and Chase Iron Eyes.
If you are outraged, if you are scared, if you are wondering what the hell just happened, how did we get into this place and what do we need to do about it, then you are in the right place. Welcome to the emergency organizing meeting to stop Trump and Pence before they come to power. Welcome to everybody here in New York City's Cooper Union who came out on this cold night, and welcome to everybody tuning in on live stream in gatherings around the country or on your own. Let me correct that. Nobody who is watching this is alone. We are in this together. My name is Sansara Taylor. I'm one of the co-initiators of the movement RefuseFascism.org. You will hear more about this tonight. And as you might have guessed by now, I am your MC for the evening. So we'll be going on this journey together. Very powerful voices are telling you that the fight is over, that Trump has won, that you should get used to pussy grabbing and neo-Nazis, white supremacists and women haters, immigrant bashing, constitution shredding, and war crimes. Get used to science deniers and planet destroyers. Get used to theocrats. Get used to hate crimes. Get used to intimidation. Get used to being scared. Get used to being silent. Get used to it all. We are here tonight to say no. Trump and Pence are not in power yet. This fight is not over, and we are not done. We are not getting used to fascism. We are getting organized to stop it. We are here tonight because we know in our gut, in our soul, in our bones, that something very, very bad has just happened. But through the course of this evening, with the incredible speakers that we have for you tonight, we're going to learn that actually, it is far worse than most of us realize. But that is not all. We are here because we want to do something about this. And tonight, our speakers are going to show us that there is something we can do about it. Not just to mark our disapproval and then get used to it. Not to try to find a way to survive the fascism that is coming, but a way to stop it, to literally change the course of history. Now, I'll tell you this right up front. This is going to take more from each of us and more from all of us together than most of us probably expected, more than many of us probably yet think we're capable of. But tonight and in the days going forward, we are going to become capable. Tonight is going to be an evening of sober-eyed confrontation with terrifying truths. And tonight is going to be a summoning of audacious daring and courage, of strength and understanding, of unity and direction. Tonight is going to be a night of transformation. Each of us becoming, and all of us together becoming, a collective force that is bursting with diversity, but steeled in a unified determination to act decisively, to bring forward millions and millions to join us to stop Trump and Pence before they come to power. So again, I want to welcome you all. You are in the right place. I look forward to spending the evening with you. I look forward to spending the next 32 intense days with you. And before we launch this evening, officially, before we bring up our first speaker of the evening, I want to ask you to do something that is your first act to spread this movement. So I want you to take out your smartphone. One, please make it be quiet. Two, take a moment. If you are on social media, if you are on Twitter, if you are on Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever you use it for, pull it out and send a message right now. Use the hashtag NoFascistUSA. That's hashtag NoFascistUSA. Say, everybody tune in now, www.refusefascism.org. There is a live stream happening now across the country. Right now, if you are at home, take out your phone, open a separate screen in your computer window, and do this. Send the message. Gather more people. Right now, gather more people to come to Cooper Union and to tune in live. We are going to grow throughout the night, and we are going to grow as we go forward. I'm going to give you a moment to do that. As you do, I want to give recognition to the initiators of this effort, some of whom are here tonight and many of whom are spread around the country. These are the beginning initiators of this effort. We have Bill Ayers. We have Herb Boyd, who is in the house tonight. Herb, will you stand up? We have Isabel Cardenas, who you'll hear from later. Carl Dix, who you'll also hear from. Niles Eldridge, Charles Gaines. Chase Ironeyes, who you'll hear from as well. Everett Ironeyes Sr., Robin D.G. Kelly, Fran Luck, who is with us tonight, P.Z. Myers, Native Lives Matter out of Minnesota, Professor Milton Sayer, myself, Sansara Taylor, Dr. Cornell West, who sends a special greeting and his enthusiastic support, Michael A. Wood, Jr., Reverend Frank Wolf, Andy Z., and David Zeiger, and this list is in formation. Send in your name, sign up, become part of this. So with that, I hope you sent out your message. Keep that hashtag in mind, NoFascistUSA, and make a habit of using it throughout the night and throughout the days going forward. Keep spreading this. So now we'll launch into our evening. I want to introduce our first speaker. He flew out from Minnesota. He is a co-initiator of this effort. He is a developmental evolutionary biologist. He is a professor who is ominously on the right-wing watch list that was just created. Something he's proud of, and it makes us proud to have him with us, but it's a very dangerous thing. He has been ranked one of the most popular science bloggers, actually the most popular science blogger and atheist blogger, alternately. His blog is called Ferengula. He is a passionate and talented popularizer of science, taking on notions like intelligent design and other things. I ask you to give a warm welcome. Join me in bringing to the stage P.Z. Myers.
Well, hello, I'm glad you're all here. So I'm standing here as a human being who is outraged by recent circumstances, just as every one of you is as well. I have no special qualities to make me uniquely representative or to warrant my presence on this stage. And if I had my way, we'd every one of us rise up and march together now, unified in our opposition. Fortunately, I think you'll have an opportunity to do that later. You'll have many opportunities to do that in this next month. So I feel a little bit humbled here because I've been asked to say a few words for one small sector of the American experience. I'm an educator and a scientist. As an educator and a scientist, in addition to as a human being, I am horrified. We have elected a post-truth president. Worse, he is actively anti-truth. He is the antithesis of everything reason and science stand for. So let me give you a few examples of Trump's anti-science stand. And all we have to do, fortunately, is look at his Twitter feed. So way back in 2014, he's been at this for a long time, there was an Ebola outbreak in Africa. And he wrote this appalling statement. He said, the U.S. cannot allow Ebola-infected people back. People that go to faraway places to help out are great, but must suffer the consequences. Think about the callous insensitivity in that remark. Not only should the innocents afflicted with this horrible disease be neglected, but the courageous medical professionals who went to their aid should be refused entry back into this country. Cowardice and an inhuman disregard for the lives of our best and bravest. Is this the man who we want to be our president?
No!
More recently, he demonstrated gross ignorance. He wrote, autism rates are through the roof. Why doesn't the Obama administration do something about doctor-inflicted autism? So he's anti-vaccination. That's a well-supported, safe medical procedure that saves millions of lives. And he's against it because he denies the robust evidence that shows that it works and refutes any claim that it causes autism. He goes further and accuses doctors of conspiring to cause autism. This is destructive to the health of our people, but then it's clear that he has little interest in helping the needy. Is this the man who we want to be president of our country? Another example of inflammatory, dangerous conspiracy theories from the Twitter feed of Mr. Trump. The concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive. That's unbelievable. Climate scientists are fundamentally unanimous in their agreement on this matter. The climate is changing. It is caused by rising concentrations of greenhouse gases. These gases are largely generated from human sources, from industry, from automobiles, from rising demands for energy produced from fossil fuels. This is a crisis, and we must respond and respond soon. Trump's response is to deny reality and to ascribe the concern to yet another conspiracy theory and to blame a foreign power. This is dangerous madness. And again, I have to ask, is this the man we want to be president of our country?
No.
It's more than just what he has said. It's what he has already done. He has appointed an Exxon executive to be his Secretary of State. His administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency is a lawyer who has always sided with the oil, coal, and gas industry and wants to destroy the EPA. His Secretary of the Interior does not accept the science of climate change and wants to strip away safeguards to protect, well, the interior. His Secretary of Energy is a man who declared his intention to destroy the office of Secretary of Energy, although he also forgot the name of the position during his campaign. I also have to mention another enduring long-term threat. His Secretary of Education is someone who campaigns to impoverish and destroy public education. Apparently, ignorance is a virtue fascism wants to encourage. Is this the man who we want to be president of our country?
No.
One last thing. These are not merely differences of opinion. Trump has embraced the fascist dream of enforcing his opinions with threats of violence. Recently, Michael Mann, a well-known and highly respected climate scientist, wrote about his experience with the thugs of the right wing who have become bolder after this election. In a Washington Post opinion piece, he wrote this, I have faced hostile investigations by politicians, demands for me to be fired from my job, threats against my life, and even threats against my family. These threats have diminished in recent years as man-made climate change has become recognized as the overwhelming scientific consensus and as climate science has received the support of the federal government. With the coming Trump administration, my colleagues and I are steeling ourselves for a renewed onslaught of intimidation from inside and outside government. It would be bad for our work and bad for our planet. And then there have been threats of violence. I've received email warnings that the public will come after you, suggesting that I'll find myself 6 feet under and hoping to read that I had committed suicide. I can tell you that Michael Mann is not alone. I teach evolutionary biology and have likewise received threats of violence, death threats, promises to get me fired from my job, threats against my family. I've been placed on the professor watch list by far-right-wing propagandists because I took a strong stand against scientifically fallacious and ethically unconscionable racism promoted by my campus neo-Nazi propagandists. This is plainly fascism, and we have no choice. We must say no in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America. Thank you.
Professors like this should be held up. They should not be hunted, okay? It's very dangerous what he's describing, so I want to thank you for coming and raising your voice with us tonight and being among us and initiating this audacious effort. I want to welcome next another initiator of this effort. She's somebody who has been active in the movement for women's liberation for many, many years, since the 70s. She's a housing rights activist. She's somebody who's been on many front lines. She's somebody who founded the Street Harassment Project and has, for nearly 20 years, pioneered feminist radio in this city, and it's reached beyond this city. She's the executive director of Joy of Resistance Multicultural Feminist Radio on WBAI Pacifica Network. Join me in welcoming Fran Luck.
It's really an honor to be here and to be among those who want to take a stand and really fight back. Well, women's rights are going to take a huge hit in a Trump-Pence administration, and the work not only of decades but of literally generations of trying to bring women out of the slough of incredible oppression that was under rule of law in the past is going to be set way, way back unless we stop it. You've heard of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, I'm going to call what women now face the three horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. They are, first of all, the groper-in-chief, Donald Trump himself, whose braggadocio about sexually assaulting women, because he could get away with it, has already led to numerous reported incidents of increased sexual harassment of women. Women are being grabbed by the crotch by men and by boys in his name. One report I've read really stands out for its symbolism. A woman in Penn Station rejected a man's advances and was told, quote, "I can't wait until Trump gets elected so I can force bitches like you to their knees." The word bitch itself, which is so often used to dehumanize women and as a precursor to violence against women, has been totally normalized by the Trump campaign. There have been Nuremberg-like rallies where hordes of people yelled, "bitch, bitch, bitch," at his opponent, Hillary Clinton, and wore t-shirts saying the same thing. In Trump's America, the terrain for women is becoming very rough and very physically dangerous. And the misogyny is, of course, intersectional, with women wearing hijabs or perceived as immigrants or women of color being doubly, triply in danger. Moving on, the second horseman of the Trumpocalypse is Mike Pence and the Christian evangelists that he represents. They want a woman to lose all autonomy in one of the most important decisions of her life, the right to decide when and if she bears children. Thousands of laws limiting this so far constitutional right to abortion have been passed in state after state so that abortion is now not obtainable in 90% of U.S. counties, although it is still on the books. There are all kinds of limitations, from forced vaginal ultrasounds to parental notifications to having to travel to other states to get abortions and spend money that you may not have on hotel rooms and all of the costs associated with that kind of travel. That will, of course, increase under a Trump administration. Trump has, of course, said that he will appoint Supreme Court justices overturning Roe versus Wade, that women should be punished for having abortions, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Under Mike Pence in Indiana, we've had recently a law that, well, we had the attempt, I should say, at a law that would force women to have funerals for fetuses, which is now just passed in Texas. Under Pence, Purvi Patel and other women have been jailed for essentially miscarriages. So we have that second horseman of the Trumpocalypse, that is Mike Pence. And we also have the right of conscience of the Christian right to deny women birth control in pharmacies and in insurance plans. So the U.S. is in danger of becoming, like many countries in the world, one where abortion is not obtainable, and this results in 60 to 70,000 women a year dying of illegal botched abortions. We are about to join those countries if we do not stop it. Lastly, we have the third horseman of the Trumpocalypse. That's Paul Ryan and his henchman Tom Price, who is the new HHS, Health and Human Services chief, and that third face is austerity. As a result of male supremacist societies, women make less money than men and are more impoverished and more dependent on public entitlements such as Social Security, food stamps, welfare, Medicare, and Medicaid. These are all programs that Paul Ryan's Congress and Tom Price's HHS want to shrink, want to privatize, want to abolish. So the overall vision for what is to happen for women if this unbelievably anti-woman misogynist administration takes shape and goes forward is a great leap backward into subservience, aka barefoot pregnant in the kitchen. And the modus operandi is, if you can't frighten them by threats of physical violence, you can force them to divert their energies into raising unwanted children, like Pence, or you can starve them into submission, like Ryan and Price want to do. So, are we going to accept this? I, for one, am not. Thousands, millions of women and our allies are not. There is already a lot of organizing going on. There's a march in Washington on the 21st. There's a women's strike by National Women's Liberation. There are all kinds of organizing taking place. And I want to commend this incredible effort, which all of us should be part of. We have got to stop them in their tracks as soon as we possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you, Fran Luck. Every time I come to the podium, I'm tempted to say, and Trump is especially aiming his venom at women, or he's especially aiming his venom at Muslims, or especially at black people. It is so all-encompassing. So we're trying to give the breadth of that, and I thank you, Fran, for bringing that front of this to us. We have all, I expect, in this room and viewing, and many, many millions around the world, been inspired and woken up by a major struggle that actually started out very small up in North Dakota. It's a fight against an oil pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's a fight that fuses the fight to save our planet and save our water from the destruction that's being wrought. And it's a fight against the ongoing genocide against Native peoples that has been going for 500 years. This began as a small encampment in April. People saying, no, we refuse to accept this. And it grew because people were courageous and they did not back down. And it grew and it inspired many others till thousands and tens of thousands have been there. Yes, I'm talking about Standing Rock. So, yeah. So we have a special treat. One of the co-initiators of this effort, his name is Chase Iron Eyes. He has been at the center of the struggle in Standing Rock. He is there now, and we're going to have a message from him. But before we have it, I just wanted to say one other thing about him. He's a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. He's a member of the Lakota People's Law Project and a co-founder of the Native American news site, Last Real Indians. He's also a co-initiator of this effort, and he is live from North Dakota.
Wow, brothers and sisters, thank you. We begin this fight. I was running for the United States Congress when this fight started, so I couldn't be completely dedicated, but I was there on the front line a few times to see the brutality, to see the constitutional, human, and civil rights violations being perpetrated by our administrative arms, the arms of our democracy that we look to be just, to be reasonable, to be objective, but which arguably now, more than ever, are susceptible to being overtaken by the corporate state. Right now, in North Dakota, you can see these violations. You can see the blood dripping from the attack dogs who were brought here to fight this oil war on American soil, on our territory, who were sicked on us by private corporate security, while our law enforcement looked the other way. You can see a collusion between law enforcement, local media, which is the only media, the National Guard, corporate security, and finally, the Republican of the Trump nature. Trump is huge here. You can see a collusion between all five of those where law enforcement tells untruths and sends press releases to the local media, and they put them out like gospel. They've been caught in lies time and time again. Luckily, now we have independent media, our own media, who can refute their claims with video evidence. But they've succeeded in racializing this fight, making it about Native American water rights, which it is, and that's enough to justify this struggle on its own. But this is about the continuing and ongoing erosion of our constitutional, human, and civil rights, and who directs the future of our very democracy? Is it we the people, or is it the corporate state? And you know that everybody who's listening here is committed 100% out here on the ground. We are committed 100%. We are about 1,000 people strong. I stepped back into the fight after my run for United States Congress ended, and I did win, but I entered a more important fight, and that fight is happening right now. So we need you to share all of our truths and keep the spotlight on us, because it's going to heat up. We are preparing for a Trump administration to approve the corporation's easement to drill under our river and to potentially contaminate our entire water resource. It's our sole drinking source right now. And so, you know, this is just getting started. The real fight has begun. And that's when I came into the scene, because we had organized, done some great work, able to provide logistical and material support in terms of humanitarian aid to the camps. They're all out there. Their spirits are lifted right now, and we're only going to get stronger. So we need your help, and we're all in this together. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Chase. We send you our love here from New York City and from around the country, and yes, we are in this fight together.
Thank you. Big thanks, guys. We'll see you on the front line.
I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to part one of a two-hour special, a two-hour broadcast of the emergency meeting to stop the Trump-Pence regime before it starts. Next up, we're going to hear from Jeremy Scahill, a founding senior editor of The Intercept and the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World's a Battlefield.
There's a lot of lessons in Standing Rock. There's a lot of lessons and there's a lot of resistance that's been happening, and I want to give a shout out to quite a bit of that later, but I want to acknowledge it now while we have Chase with us and people in the crowd who've been there. Next, I want us to turn our attention. We're going to bring a speaker who's going to come and give us another angle on this administration, of this regime, of this threat that is looming. He's somebody who has been on the front lines of war reporting around the world, from Afghanistan to Iraq, to Somalia, to Yemen, Nigeria, the former Yugoslavia, and beyond. He's somebody who is the author of two bestsellers, Dirty Wars and Blackwater. He's somebody many of you know from his work at The Intercept as a founding editor and as a contributor where he started at Democracy Now! Please join me in welcoming Jeremy Scahill.
Well, I'm so, well, troubled to be here with you on the one hand, but also humbled at hearing our brother speaking to us from Standing Rock. And, you know, I'm from the state of Wisconsin originally, and one of the longest serving political prisoners in this country is from Wisconsin, an indigenous man named Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier is one of my heroes. And the treatment of Leonard Peltier by the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and every presidential administration since he was framed of killing two FBI agents and then sentenced to life in prison has been one more injustice committed against Native people in this country. And it is shameful that President Obama seemingly is not going to pardon Leonard Peltier. Well, he may pardon some donors if they got hooked up and saw him. He can go Clinton on them. I also want to echo something that Chase was saying there via Skype about the role of private security at Standing Rock. You see, one of the things that has happened in the post-9/11 reality in this country, and unfortunately then in the rest of the world, is that the United States has renewed its addiction to mercenary forces. And I'm going to talk in a moment about Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, who is the sister of Eric Prince, the founder of the Blackwater Mercenary Force. But the mercenary firm at Standing Rock that was coordinating all of the other so-called private security companies, that's what they want to be called, that were attacking protesters with dogs, that were monitoring the communications of activists, and were participating in the brutality that we saw unleashed against Native people and their allies, the main firm that was coordinating this is a firm called Tiger Swan. And Tiger Swan was started by a former member of the U.S. Army's Delta Force named Jim Reese. This is a company that has both covert and overt contracts for the U.S. government in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And what the hell are they doing then being sent down to be mercenaries going after attacking indigenous people in this country under Mr. Transformative Nobel Prize winning president, who took so long after so many dog bites, beatings, spraying in the freezing cold of people to finally sort of do something. I bring this up about President Obama because I think we all have to remember history. Now, I'm all in favor of saying no to fascism over Trump. And that is what we're facing with this administration. We're facing a normalization of what are clearly fascist, racist, white supremacist viewpoints that now are going to ascend in both an overt and covert way to the most powerful offices in this land. It's not that white supremacy hasn't always governed this country's interests, certainly on a domestic level, but also in its wars. It's that Trump is out in the open and bringing with him an empowerment. Who would have thought that we would be talking about the Ku Klux Klan in the way that we are today? What he is doing, and I think so many of the undecided voters that came out and voted for him were white supremacists who haven't been voting, and then they were energized. They had the hope and change message from Trump, sort of the bizarro version of it, and they came out and voted for the first time. Trump is not the Ku Klux Klan's candidate of choice, but Trump and the Ku Klux Klan went into a marriage of convenience that is going to serve both of their interests, and Trump bears all responsibility for the attacks that happen against black people in this country as a result of him winning this election. And he wasn't dog whistling to the Ku Klux Klan. He was openly whistling at them, saying, come on out, the party's gonna start. It's open season on black people. It's open season on immigrants in this country. It's open season on people who are wearing a hijab or a burqa or a niqab. It's open season on anyone who doesn't believe that this country is white and should always be white. That's the message that was sent to these people in an overt way from the podium of his candidacy, and now it's going to be from his presidential Twitter feed and from the people that he puts into power. But let's not just put all of this on Trump is a fascist, we need to mobilize against this. These are moments where if we don't learn from history, we're going to keep doing this over and over and over. I sort of refer to the Democrats as rake steppers. You know, the rake is in their backyard, and it's been in the same damn place since the beginning of the foundation of their party, and they always step, bam, and hit themselves in the face again by being vegetarians between meals. Oh, we're against war when it's Bush. Oh, no, Trump is a fascist. We better stand up now. Oh, my God, the Electoral College is a terrible thing. But where are these people when Obama's drone striking American citizens? Where are these people when Obama rebranded the Extraordinary Rendition Program as something else? By the way, it was started by President Bill Clinton, the last Democrat before the 4 years of Cheney and Bush. Obama is the deporter in chief, has gone after immigrants in this country in an unprecedented manner, even making George Bush look a little bit more humane at times because Obama wrapped it in the language of love and concern for immigrants in this country. The upholding of the USA Patriot Act and then its ultimate expansion. The spying that was conducted by the NSA. You don't think Obama knew that they were collecting data on millions of unsuspecting Americans? Of course he did. And his director of national intelligence, James Clapper, went in front of the US Senate and committed perjury when Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon asked him directly, are you collecting any form of data on American citizens? And he lied, and nothing has happened to him. In fact, he's celebrating that he's going to be retiring right now. The thing is, if you look at Bill Clinton's administration, and you go back that far, which for some people in this room may be very far, or even before you were born, but let's talk about what happened under Bill Clinton. Under Bill Clinton, the US initiated the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam in Iraq under the guise of the so-called no-fly zones. Clinton presided over the most ruthless regime of economic sanctions in history that disproportionately targeted civilians, particularly young babies, pregnant women, and elderly people in Iraq. And they called those humanitarian sanctions that were aimed at toppling Saddam Hussein's regime. Now, I was in Iraq a lot during that period, and I can tell you that the hospitals of Iraq under Bill Clinton's administration looked like death rows for infants, filled with doctors who were educated in American and British universities, knew how to treat patients of their ailments, but were not allowed to import basic analgesics. They were reusing needles over and over. They didn't have bleach or anything to clean or sanitize, so they were using a resource Iraq had a lot of, which was oil. And so all of the hospitals in Iraq were a mixture of the stench of death, blood, and gasoline. And if you think of the symbolism of that stench in the hospitals of Iraq during this period, it tells you a lot about what Bill Clinton and his administration were doing in Iraq at the time. In 1998, regime change in Iraq became the official law of the United States of America. And you know who voted for that? Well, first of all, let me tell you who wrote it. Who wrote it were the neocons. William Kristol, Donald Rumsfeld, all of the people you would imagine when Clinton was president, wrote a letter under the banner of the Project for a New American Century. And they said to Bill Clinton, we need to make regime change the law of the land in Iraq. And Bill Clinton endorsed that. It then went to the House and the Senate, and Bernie Sanders voted for it. Bernie Sanders supported regime change in Iraq going as far back as 1998 and never once had to answer a question about that because we were too busy focusing on the kind of cult of personality around this and not the actual issues. I would have loved to have seen Bernie have an actual progressive who knew what they were talking about interrogate him on his own very troubled foreign policy record. We can blast Hillary Clinton like a pinata because it's so convenient, because she's the very representation of everything wrong with the elite in this country, of the thieving, of the cronyism, of the whitewashing of what are called war crimes by liberals under Republicans and then humanitarian interventions under Democrats. Hillary Clinton's the low-hanging fruit to hit at right now. You want to go after someone? Go after someone that, like Bernie Sanders, who's saying, hey, I'm the change that's going to really shake up the two-party system here. But he never had to answer any actual tough questions about his horrible policy positions. Was he better on many issues than Hillary Clinton? Of course he was. Was he saying something that is news to many people in this room? No. What made the difference in all of this was that the media had to pay attention to Bernie Sanders because he started polling high. And Hillary Clinton, she was afraid to say his name for 3 months. Why did she say his name? Because, oh, Bernie's starting to rise in the polls. So then cameras start to show up. And it's like, I mean, Bernie Sanders is a curmudgeonly, cranky, non-friendly kind of character in many ways. I mean, I used to hang up on me when I would call him a Democracy Now. But he was saying something that so many people in this country agree with, fundamental truths about our financial system, about our social system. It showed that when you give someone exposure, when people are exposed to these ideas, it's not about the cult of personality of Bernie Sanders, it's about the ideas. And that should be our biggest source of inspiration from this electoral process, is that we are actually many. There are many, many of us. And if a really old white man like Bernie Sanders is what ignites the fire, imagine if we had a bunch of young people who were insisting the stage is ours, we are saying these things. But you see, the Democrats, their role is to clean up the image of the empire so that it can continue again. So what did we have with Obama? Well, under Bush, we had, of course, the Patriot Act. Only one U.S. Senator, Russ Feingold, voted against it. The authorization for the use of military force, the so-called blank check, only one member of Congress, the entire Congress, voted against that, and that was Representative Barbara Lee of California. And let me tell you something, Barbara Lee is one of the few African Americans in the Congress. She got death threats, her office was targeted. It should be required viewing for every young person in this country to watch the speech that Barbara Lee gave just days after 9/11 on the floor of the U.S. Congress, when her own party and the Republicans were caving in on that woman, and she stood up and she committed an act of prophecy. She said, this is what's going to happen if you give them a blank check. We will engage in a war that will never end. We are going to open a Pandora's box of history that cannot be closed. She was the only one of those crooked lawmakers who actually saw the truth as though it was true. And I think when you go back and you look at that, you realize there are transformative moments when people, for whatever reason, rise up and actually shatter the paradigm of the moment. And often they're denounced as the radicals, the extremists, the crazies. But the radicals, the extremists, and the crazies are the only people that have ever actually fundamentally changed the course of history. The Electoral College isn't going to change. We could flip it over, and then we won't have an overt fascist, and I would be very glad if somebody other than Trump was there. Let's be clear on that. Just basic common sense about the kind of war on women that we're going to see, where you're going to have women who get pregnant facing an utterly criminalized abortion system. Already we have doctors being assassinated, women being harassed, attacks against people who want access to safe and affordable women's health care, including abortion procedures, because it is part of women's health care to choose to have an abortion. But under Trump, that could be criminalized. Doctors could be prosecuted. If they get two Supreme Court justices, I'm not a very religious man, but I'm praying for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I really hope she stays alive. But they're going to have two Supreme Court justices, and one of them could be someone like Ted Cruz. That's going to have a multi-generational impact. But if Hillary Clinton had won the election, we would have had a candidate of regime change. We would have had a candidate of empire. On a foreign policy level, there's ways in which she could be even more dangerous than Trump. And so what does that tell us? It tells us that these two forces have way more in common with each other than they do with almost any of us. And what does it mean then when we have our first African-American president who becomes the drone warlord, who says we have the right to assassinate American citizens who have not been charged with any crime, and assassinate then 2 weeks later one of their 16-year-old sons, who no one came up with any evidence that this kid had anything to do with terrorism. Obama legitimized or sought to use his credibility as Mr. Nobel Prize-winning constitutional law scholar, transformative president. He used his credibility to seek to legitimize the worst aspects of the Bush-Cheney doctrine. He did a whitewashing of the drone program and convinced people that somehow drones are the alternative to boots on the ground. And you saw it where, I mean, MSNBC basically was MSDNC, where they were just pumping out the propaganda for Obama, they would have made the barons of the Soviet media empire's propaganda machine blush with how extreme their propaganda was and has been over President Obama. But Obama used his legitimacy, and now at the end, he's starting to get a little worried about what he did. So he says, oh, well, we're going to have to put some rules in about these drone strikes. Well, yeah, that's nice that you're doing that now that we're like 30 days away from Donald Trump. You're going to say, well, maybe there should be some rules to how we do this. You know what happened is that the cult of personality around Obama meant that when they took polls of people on drone strikes, well, I just trust Obama. You know, Obama always says there's not a blue America and a red America, it's the United States of America. There's not Republican drone strikes and Democratic drone strikes. There's not Republican cruise missiles and Democratic cruise missiles. There are cruise missiles and drone strikes of the United States of America. And Obama has now made it possible for Trump to basically say, F*** you, to the Democrats if they raise any questions about it. They're like, your Nobel Prize winner was doing this, Henry Kissinger style. It's insane what happened here. And now we are stuck with this reality of Trump and Pence and the rising sort of overt nature of their fascist administration, in part because of who the Democrats are, because of what the Democratic Party stands for. The U.S. has a tradition, and it requires a waiver if someone who has been in a senior position in the military is going to be appointed to oversee a civilian agency, a military agency, and they're going to be the civilian in charge of it. But Trump is appointing general after general after general to top posts. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who is his national security advisor, who, by the way, does not need to be confirmed by the Senate. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn was General Stanley McChrystal's top deputy when McChrystal was the head of the elite assassination force, the Joint Special Operations Command. He was the guy that drew up the plans for the United States to, and as they put it, kill their way through Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a force that has been totally unaccountable and empowered further under the Obama administration. He also is a radical Islamophobe who truly does believe that Islam as a religion needs to be destroyed, not just people who conduct terrorist attacks and say they're doing it in the name of Islam. He wants the religion wiped out. General James Mattis, who led the siege of Fallujah when he was a commander on the ground in Iraq, he's the one that intervened and got the guys who did the Haditha massacre off the hook. He said sometimes it's just fun to shoot people, talking about killing people in Afghanistan, who he said, oh, these people beat women and make them wear burqas. Now, I'm against beating women, and the burqa issue is a complicated one if we want to actually have a discussion on that. But last time I checked, the U.S. does not give the death penalty to people who beat their wives or people who wear burqas. And if you have a U.S. military commander basically saying, I bet those guys beat their wives, not we have evidence, we're going to take them to court, so I'm going to shoot them and it's fun, think of the message that kind of sends to the world when you have our Secretary of Defense is a guy who says it's certainly fun to shoot some people, meaning Muslim men in Afghanistan. You have General John Kelly, who is a vicious anti-immigrant closed border advocate, who now is going to be in charge of the Department of Homeland Security. Then you have Admiral Mike Rogers, who's going to be running all of the spy operations through the DNI. And I could go on for a half hour or more about all of these guys, but I want to end by telling you about Mike Pence. I've been following Mike Pence's career for more than a decade. Mike Pence actually was raised a Kennedy Democrat Catholic in Indiana, and he was converted on the spot to evangelical Christianity at a Christian music festival. Very strong-willed guy, ready to take the reins of power. He goes to like the Christian right version of Lollapalooza and is like, oh yeah, I'm yours. And that's gonna be our vice president. But he is one of the greatest holy warriors in the eyes of the radical religious right. He has been groomed for many years to be their sort of white horse running in to save the country from vicious secularism and scary atheists and gay people, and the list goes on. Mike Pence is what we call a theoconservative. He is a theological fascist, a Christian supremacist. Well, I called him a Christian jihadist, and boy, did they go nutty over that. And I'm like, you know, because you don't know what the word jihad means. Oh, I know what it means. I'm just saying, like, well, when you use it next time, how about you think about the way you're using it? But he is a Christian jihadist. I think we should use the terms that they use for everybody else. Talk about them. These guys are they're the American Taliban. They're the Christian jihadists. But what they want is a country that essentially functions as a theocracy on social matters and foreign policy, and then functions as a playground for the ultra-rich and the destroyers of the environment. On their domestic policies and their social platform is straight out of the 1300s. And these guys, Mike Pence and the people that put him there, know what they're doing. I want to see the story of how Trump ended up getting Pence put onto him, because Trump looked like he had to, like, you know, leave the room immediately. We come out, he's like, well, this is Mike Pence. I'll see you guys later. Great, great, great. That was not some friend of his. They had only met once before. I'm telling you, Pence is the Trojan horse of this election for the radical religious right. And I think that, you know, it's going to be interesting to see who plays the fascist chess game better, Trump or Pence, because Pence is a very dangerous person. Pence also is very close to the Blackwater mercenary firm, which brings me to the last point. Betsy DeVos, who is the sister of Eric Prince, the owner or the founder of Blackwater, who, by the way, now is showing his American patriotism by operating a private security company in China with ties to Chinese intelligence. Great, just great, America. He's making China great again for Donald Trump by having a mercenary firm in China. His sister is going to be the Secretary of Education. What Eric Prince wants for the military and the CIA, sort of radical privatization, which comes with less and less regulation, less and less oversight, less and less accountability, and a lot more killing, she wants for education. She believes in a radically privatized school system, and she also simultaneously believes that government funding should go to provide religious education, Christian religious education, across the United States. She is one of the only people in the cabinet richer than Donald Trump. She married Dick DeVos, the heir to the Amway Corporation fortune, the people that used to own the Orlando Magic basketball team. And the Prince family and the DeVos family merged like the monarchies of old Europe. And they gave all the original seed money in the late 80s, early 90s to financing the organizations that became known as Focus on the Family. James Dobson, Gary Bauer. These were the families that gave most of the money to the rise of the radical religious right. It is no coincidence then that Betsy DeVos is the education secretary and that Mike Pence is the vice presidential candidate. Those two, I would say, are two of the individuals in this cabinet to watch so vigilantly because they know how to do damage. This isn't Ben Carson wandering the halls of housing and urban development trying to figure out where the bathroom is. He's going to be in charge of making you homeless and underdeveloped at HUD. But these are serious people who have a very hateful agenda. They hate gay people with a passion. Imagine their Christmas dinner. Who's worse, honey, the fags or the Mexicans? Oh, I just don't know. I saw some people kissing the other day, and they both appeared to be, I don't even know what gender they were. And then Eric Prince comes in, and it's like, oh, well, I just killed some more Muslims. It's like a very sick family, and they're in an unprecedented position of power. So we're in this moment now where I think if we fail to understand that part of how we got here is that many liberals and many people, even good-hearted, smart people, go to sleep when the Democrats are in power. And if you look back on the 8 years and all of us ask ourselves, like, what did we do while this was going on? You know, where were we when the drone strike stuff happened, when Obama started wars in Somalia and Yemen, and then another war in Iraq, and then surged in Afghanistan, and then they did the coup in Honduras, and then they continued with the neoliberal economic agenda that punishes the poor and sends U.S. workers to a race to the bottom of the wage scale with people from around the world. Where were you when all of this was happening? And if you don't have much to say for it, then you got a lot of catching up to do with the work that needs to be done, because Trump isn't just the product of a bunch of racist hillbillies voting for him. There were people who voted twice for Obama and then voted for Trump. And the question as to why is one that we should be asking ourselves, but also getting away from this illusion that if we just elect Hillary, or we just elect another Democrat, or if we just get out in the midterms, that anything will fundamentally change, then we're whistling past the graveyard. And the last thing I'll say to you is that, you know, we need to realize that unless we shatter this two-party system, nothing's ever going to fundamentally change in this country. Unless we get corporations away from controlling all of the politicians in this country, nothing will ever fundamentally change in terms of what Washington has to offer people. And we've all been hoodwinked into this funnel that every 2 years or every 4 years, boy, if you don't support John Kerry, then Bush is going to be... No, I'm sick of that. You know, let's call the truth true and say the whole filthy system is the problem, and it helped to produce a fascist that we must all, with every fiber in our body, oppose until he is no longer there. Thank you.
All right, once again, that was Jeremy Scahill, a founding senior editor of The Intercept and the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army and Dirty Wars.
All right, we are here because we are determined. You heard a lot just now, but I want to say two things. I want to highlight two things, and then we're going to bring up our next speaker. Stick with this program. You just heard a lot of things, including a lot of things that have been going on, a lot of what gave rise to the situation and the extreme dangers of Trump and DeVos and Pence. This is a qualitative leap. This is fascism, and people do have a lot of making up to do. And one thing to take from what a number of people have been saying, but also what we just heard, is there is no Democrat going to save us. There's nobody out there who's going to save us but us, the masses of people, regular people, regular people. Not waiting 4 years, not making a plan for the midterms, acting now decisively, relying on ourselves, looking out to the millions who've been trained that it's not their place to take history into their own hands. It is our place. It is our duty right now.
You've been listening to part one of a special broadcast of the emergency meeting to stop the Trump-Pence regime before it starts. You can find more about this meeting and the movement at refusefascism.org. And I'd like to thank everyone involved in this special, and WBAI, the Pacifica Network station in New York City, for the audio recording that was used in this special. We're going to go out now with Fighting Song from Outer National.
Shot to